Welcome to the Child Welfare Leaders Podcast, where we challenge the status quo and inspire you to lead change right where you are. I'm your host, Cherish Fields. If this is your first time listening, I'm glad that you found this podcast. I know you will enjoy the conversations we have, so feel free to catch up on the previous episodes and tune in every last Sunday of the month to hear brand new episodes. If you like what you hear, share with a fellow child welfare leader or others interested in the field. For those returning listeners, thank you for your continued support of this podcast. Don't forget, it helps when you leave a review and take a moment to share on your social media. I have something special for you. It's a bonus episode. I am joined by a special guest who is placing a call to action to change child welfare. We know this is what we're fighting for because the status quo will no longer do. So I'm glad to have connected with someone that is calling action to get it done. So I need you to grab your coffee and tune in as we dive into this conversation and invite you to take action. My guest joining us on today's episode is someone I'm grateful to have connected with and who inspired me as a leader as a result of our conversation. My guest is master level social worker and associate professor in pediatrics at the Kemp Center for Prevention and Treatment of Child Abuse and Neglect at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. She's an international leader of family group decision making, which is implemented in over 25 countries and growingly recognized as a restorative and healing approach. She plays a leadership role in Kemp's system transformation portfolio, which includes the annual Call to Action to Change Child Welfare Conference and a national initiative on differential response in child protective services. I'm excited to welcome Lisa Merkel Ogwin. She's an amazing thought leader, which I think you will equally be inspired by. Hear the conversation that I had the pleasure of having coming up next. Hey, Lisa, it's so great to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Cherish, for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
No problem. I'm thankful we got connected because when I saw the ad in the 2021, a call to action to change child welfare conference, which we will have provide more details on that later, I had to reach out and learn more. And I did not expect to be able to talk to the leader behind the vision, but I'm so happy that we got to chat a little bit.
Likewise.
You have many years of experience in the child welfare, you know, field. And I realized that we share the same passion to change what we're doing in child welfare. So I would love for you to tell us more about that and how you got here and what kind of inspired the vision.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had the privilege to work to try to make the lives of children, families, and communities better for close to 30 years. And I've done a lot of work in child welfare practice and policy and training and research. And I've worked in a number of different local organizations as well as some national organizations around the country, from the Child Welfare League of America when I was really young to the American Humane Association to now the Kemp Center. And I was fortunate back in 1994 that when the American Humane Association got a grant from the Edna McConnell Clark Foundation that was looking to think about how do we reform child welfare. And they awarded American Humane a grant to study this process called family group conferencing, which was a process that really put families in position to lead decision making when their children were reported for child abuse or neglect or for juvenile offenses. And it brought me into touch with people all around the world, particularly in New Zealand, where this became a legislated way of working. And it was kind of from that exposure to Indigenous practices and principles and Maori leaders and then other thought leaders around the world that I thought back in 1994, which is what, close to 30 years ago now, boy, I have a passion for reform. There are things that need significant change, and how can I be a force for good in that way? And so that's kind of historically how I got excited about this. And then the pandemic happened. right? And the pandemic just created that opportunity for a team where the world stopped. And then we had a racial reckoning because of the murder of George Floyd. And our team at the Kemp Center sat there and thought, is this the way we want to continue living? Can we do more? Can we do better? And one of my teammates said, who is a racial justice advocate, just an expert in DEIJ work, she said, I think we need to create a call to action. Because ultimately, as a team, we decided we weren't okay with perpetuating really what became kind of like a sense of insanity, right? We're doing the same thing, we're tinkering with it a little bit, but we're expecting different results, but we get no different results. And so we said, let's do a call to action, and that's how it started back in 2020.
Well, now we have, this conference, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But, you talked about the pandemic and how it slowed all of us down, right? So we had a chance to kind of reevaluate not only just what we do, but how we live, right? And so I think
Right.
that being able to take that time and step back from our work that we do on the day to day, I think it challenged us a lot, right? So we were also able to see things like, well, people weren't making as many calls, right? To
Right.
CPS, to investigate homes. You had issues also where women, were at risk of being further, in danger, if they had an abusive spouse. You had nowhere to go, right? Because everything was
Right.
locked down. So it was just like this new way of living. And for social workers, that scared us,
Yeah.
because it was like, how do we help? And then we were on lockdown, because I remember where I was working in a residential treatment facility, and the pandemic really had us nervous because we were like, well, we got to be here for these kids. So my thought was, what are they going to do with the kids if we can't come to work? So I think that the
Right.
state was trying to figure out what to do. The federal, government was trying to figure out how to lead, in that, in all of that was going on, and let alone the stress, right? Because everybody could clearly see the more divided we were, and on so many issues. And so I know in my mind, I was thinking, how do we unite us, right? How do we find a way to deal with the issues and not just overcome them, you know what I mean? But heal from them, right? And
Right.
so it was like, and I couldn't help but to think about the children. Right? Because even in the George Floyd situation, his daughter is left without a father, right? So there's a
Absolutely.
community, that I'm pretty her mom, and I'm sure mom has friends and other people that, have supported. And I know that many people, have at least offered, I believe, to give her scholarship, give the daughter scholarships and make sure she's taken care of. But what about the kids who don't have that, who don't have the family, who don't have the community that really know that they're in the system lingering, right? So
Yeah, I
how
mean,
do
I
we
think
help?
our, yeah, I mean, our position is that every single one of us has a family, right? Every child is nested in a family system. And what child welfare systems have done systematically for decades now is they have othered those family systems. They have devalued those family systems. They say, well, this kid doesn't have a family. No, every kid has a family. The reality is, we haven't necessarily found their family. We haven't invested the resources and time to find them. And then when we find them, we don't see them. We don't see their humanity, their imperfections, and their perfections. We have additional policies and structures and that oftentimes even create more barriers for child welfare agencies' ability to place children and with their family systems that we think can support them And what you said, Cherish, which was really resonated with me, was we need to create a system that heals and that creates an opportunity for people to belong to one another.
Yes.
And that's what we're hoping to encourage, kind of a new way of thinking, because that's what every human wants. You want to belong and feel connected. We know from research in a number of other scientific sectors, we know that social isolation is the silent killer.
Yeah.
And they study this a lot in the area of aging. And yet we've created a system that perpetuates social isolation. So that's what we're hoping to do. We're hoping to raise the conversation and think about these really perplexing, complex, philosophically, you know, difficult topics.
Yeah, I like that because, you know, one thing, when I became a social worker, you know, I went through my program and I learned so much. So what's interesting is I didn't really set out to be a social worker per se. It was kind of something where I don't know, it kind of just happened. I hate to say that it just happened, but it did. It just, I was led to apply through encouragement from some peers. And I applied and I got in. And so I just started just to follow the yeses. That's essentially what I did. I followed the yeses. So when I got in, I clearly was like, okay, what do I study? And of course, mm-hmm. they had a child welfare track. So I was like, okay, let me look further into and let me, you know, study what I came from, right? Because the automatic thought for me was, you've been there, done that. You don't want no more parts of it. Of that system. You know,
sure.
that was really a thought. But there was also a part of me that wanted change so bad because there were so many things in my own lived experience that I was like, we could have did that better. Right. But I had to mm-hmm. understand the system that I experienced before I could really speak on it. Right. So
right.
what my program did was really help me understand the system. And I was actually very saddened because though this system was set to help, it does more harm than it does good. And I realized it's because sometimes we create policies or we reform policies that we think are going to change things, but they don't. They actually end up working against each other. Or what I've said that happens is you have all these policies and they conflict with each other. So it's almost like a war of policies against each other mm-hmm. because they're not working in sync. They're not working seamlessly. They're conflicting because sometimes the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, you know? So I've
you
always...
Think, go ahead. Yeah, I'm just curious, Cherish, do you ever think though that the policies are set up to do exactly what they were intended to do?
You know, and that's another side of the argument. Yes, I do. That's what makes it so complex because you try to understand it, right? I know I have. I've tried to understand why do we have this policy that does this? But then we're saying, right, we have a lot of people and advocates and people who even support certain policies saying this, but then we pass this, right? So that mm-hmm. how is that going to help or create an open door for this to happen so that people can do it. But I 100%, but I always struggled with the fact that we know what's wrong, but yet somehow we don't know how to fix it. We know what's wrong, but we don't know how to fix it.
Or we don't have the will to fix it.
That I've struggled with. And I'm always, which is one of the reasons why I created this podcast too, because I wanted to talk to people and have conversations. We know what's happening. We know this is wrong. What is it going to take? Who do we need to talk to? Who do we need to connect with? How do we need to unite? Because we know that things have to change. And I know for me, I'm tired of the, you know, small changes, right? You know, and I've talked about this on the podcast as well of, you know, I come from Michigan, and Michigan has been in a lawsuit,
you know, from children's rights for 14 years. And they've had the same incident, which led them to be sued, just recently happened during the pandemic. So it's like, we said we were changing. We had agreement with the government that, hey, this is what we're doing. This is what we're changing. But it's not just Michigan, but many states. We're kind of in that same place. Like you said, we're doing the same thing. It's almost insanity, right? And yet we're not yielding different results. So I love
that's what Einstein would say, right?
Right. So I love when I saw the conference, it was really intriguing, you know, as well. And then I saw the lineup of, you know, speakers. And it's funny because I was actually just talking to my class about, and I've also recommended her book, Dorothy Roberts, The Shattered Bonds, you know, just, I was like, oh, I would love to hear from her. And I'm like, more people need to hear because she's really called for, you know, to abolish the system. Right. And so,
She actually started 20 years ago, right, with her Shattered Bonds book, thinking we could reform the system. Maybe we could transform it. We could make some policy changes. And I think it's through her 20 years of study. And I have the utmost respect for Dorothy Roberts, brilliant legal scholar, sociologist, who's at the University of Pennsylvania now. And I think it's over her time thinking, I don't think we can transform this system. I do think she comes from the opinion now that we need to abolish it. And it's a bold call, for sure. There are many people who are in opposition to what she is suggesting, but she's actually, Cherish, coming out with a brand new book here, I think next month. Around really putting the child protection system into a framework of it being a family regulation and family policing system.
Yeah.
And how it targets, some would say unintentionally, some would say intentionally, Black and brown bodies.
Yep.
And, you know, I can't wait for that book to come out.
I can't either.
Mainly because we need thought leaders like that, because to get better, you have to be challenged by provocative ideas. And I think what her book is really going to get at, my guess, is these structural, systemic, kind of wide-reaching inequalities and oppressions that are experienced by families who are subject to the interventions of child welfare agencies. And again, I stand in awe of someone who can seam together all of the research, because there's plenty of it out there, in a new framework that pushes us to be better.
Yeah. And I didn't even know she was coming out with a new book. I know she was, I've listened to some guest speaking that she's done. And I know that she's, you know, that's how I've heard about the abolish the system, you know. And when I saw, you know, that you were having her as a speaker at the conference, I was like, yeah, I want to hear more. So I'm excited to hear that she has another book coming out, because I know it's been some time, but I have a lot of respect for her too, and what she, you know, has written and what she speaks out about, because I do think it's bold. And I love bold. I love bold and courageous. And I like when we go radical, because those are the people that change, you know, systems and change the way we think about systems. You know, it takes that. It can't be the status quo. It can't be the thought, well, this is the way it is. It has to be, no, there is a different way, and we got to think differently before it can be different, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I love that you're putting people like that, and thought leaders, and having guests that are going to make us have these conversations and challenge our thought patterns as child welfare professionals, because it's so needed. You know, it's not your, when I saw this conference, I was like, oh, this is not your traditional conference where you're gonna sit down and you're gonna, you know, learn maybe, you know, this skill or that skill, be talked to. It seems that with the structure set up, it's gonna be conversations. Yes, you're gonna hear some new ideas and some new thoughts, but it's going to help trigger your own thinking, right? And help you be a part of that conversation, you know, to actually take action.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we know that system transformation, right? There's this, there are people that are kind of doing continuous quality improvement on the existing system, trying to make the existing system better. We have people that are calling for reform and transformation, and we have abolitionists who are amongst our group. And I think what we all have in common is that we are now starting to understand the context of where child welfare systems sit. So we know that it's going to require political, economic, social, and legal changes. These structural change, we have to change the structures and how governments and communities interact with one another. We have to begin the conversation around redistributing resources, power, and decision-making. That's kind of what the abolitionists bring into the space, right? I mean, in some ways, it mimics the defund the police conversation that's happening. Many people in the defund the police movement, one of the subtexts that oftentimes doesn't get talked about is that their hope is that, or some of their hopes, I suppose, is that they really want police to be more connected with their community, to go to more of a restorative approach to crime, to do more community policing or community safety, even if we take the word policing out of the conversation. And that's what I think our abolitionists are bringing to the table. They're talking about, how do we redistribute resources? How do we think about decision making differently in child welfare? So in our conference, we're asking some tough questions, and we're asking people to come into conversation. And it's not that any of us has the right answer or the answer, if there is an answer, but we feel like we have to struggle with one another. We think that we have to be courageous in our conversations. So we need to start answering questions like, why do we think professionals should be making decisions for family systems? What is it about us that sidelines kin? What is it that encourages us to support strangers to raise children? I know one of our more provocative speakers, Richard Wexler, is going to talk about the role of CASA, you know, the court-appointed special advocate. He's calling it the sacred cow, and really asking people to look at the research around that particular advocacy approach and think about whether or not that continues to perpetuate some of the outcomes that we oftentimes talk about in child welfare that we're actually not, you know, if we're trying to keep children connected and reunified with their family system, there's some evidence to suggest that CASA actually results in more kids being removed from their family systems.
Wow.
So we want to have these conversations, and we want to do it on an international scale. So we'll have people from, we have presenters from over 25 countries, because as I like to say, the one thing that America has done well is that we've exported our child welfare system all over the globe. People tend to look to America for ideas, right? Kind of that shiny beacon on the hill. Yeah. And that is true around child welfare. So, and kind of all the colonization that has taken place, and how that's got embedded in child welfare, that's happening, you know, really all around the globe. So this call to action is a global call to action, because so many of the child welfare systems look the same, harm Black and Brown bodies disproportionately, minimize and marginalize Indigenous practices and ways of working. And we think that we have to, that we can learn so much from one another, even though we know that, you know, what the social safety network looks different in the Scandinavian countries. We know that the economic policies that support children and families are vastly different in comparison in other countries as to perhaps what we've seen here in the U.S. And we're also, the other thing that I think we're trying to do is delve deep into some of these policy structures. And so, you know, really delighted to have some of my colleagues from Chapin Hall who are going to be starting to raise the conversation around economic policy and how that is so closely tied to the work in child welfare. So we're delighted. We have 220 sessions. The conference is a little wild in the sense that, as you were saying, Cherish, we believe we have to bring people into conversation. So we are going to have things called conversation circles. We have these other, kind of medium called media circles, where we bring really provocative media from a TED Talk or a podcast into the space for about, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes. And then we have our expert facilitators from the Kemp Center who engage whoever comes into that circle in a conversation about, let's talk about that. Let's try that on. Let's debate that, discuss it. What did you agree with? What pushed your buttons? What didn't you agree with? We think through those types of conversation come growth and the willingness of more people to join a call to action.
I love it. And I'm excited, so excited about it. Before we get into providing the exact details about the conference, I do want to come back because you are my guest. And I want to maybe highlight a little bit about in your field of, you know, in your experience in the field, what are some challenges that you really saw? Like what things that maybe people don't really talk about that you, but you experience that you see in child welfare? Because I think it's important for us to kind of raise some of the things that we probably all of us feel, but don't really say, you know, when we're in this work. Are there any, you know, maybe one experience you could highlight a little bit for us? And then I want to make sure that we share the details about the conference so we can get people registered.
Sure. You know, I had a transformative experience myself back in 2003, and it was in, or I met this family, and I think we all have these kind of experiences with people come into our lives, and especially when we're doing this work of social work, where we can make the difference in an individual's life. And we were running a conference around family group decision-making, right? And that's a practice and kind of it's a structural reform. Oftentimes it boils down to a practice, but if done right, it's really a major structural reform, which positions families to lead decisions about the children, you know, for and with the children in their lives when they've come to the attention of child welfare. And I had this dad who came up to me at this conference, and he had actually, he was from a very large county in California, and we were in Minneapolis. So they were delighted because their county had actually sponsored them to come and participate and speak at our event. And I give a lot of credit to this social worker, her name was Jocelyn, who really believed in the inherent power and voice of families. And this family, I'll give him the name of Frank. Frank's child had been in the child welfare system for about 8 years. And he was a war veteran, had quite a bit of PTSD, and was in the relationship with, still in the relationship with the mother of his child. And I don't exactly know all the circumstances to why the child was removed, but what I do know is that Frank fought tirelessly for the return of his child into his family system. And he carried this, and when I met him, actually his child had returned home, and he was parenting his son, Frank Jr. And he carried this manila envelope with him. And remember, this child had been in care for 8 years. Frank had been described as hostile and angry And he did everything that was in, according to him and to the social worker who referred him to this family group decision-making practice, Frank had done everything. He had done everything the child welfare system asked him to do in a case plan. You want me to go to substance abuse treatment? From his vantage point, he didn't have a substance abuse issue, but he said, I'll do it. You say I'm angry that I need to go to a parenting class? I'll go to the parenting class. Every service that the child welfare agency put in that case plan, Frank did, and he did on time. But he was categorized as an angry Black man because he was fighting for his kid, because he was fighting against the injustice, because he wanted to parent. For 8 years, he fought. And then the social worker came into his life, and she decided she was running this family group decision-making program in this large county. And she went to her team and she said, give me the toughest cases you've got. Right. And we should even think about that language. Why in child welfare, which is supposed to be a system that humanizes people, we need to start thinking about our language. Families become cases, right? Like even just how we other people in our language. So she said, I'd like to work with the most challenging families that you work with. And this one social worker said, I've got a case file. And it was 2 feet deep. And she went through that case file. And what she realized is that this family, this Frank Jr. had 30 some odd relatives who were noted in this case file. And she noted that this dad was just advocating so strongly and doing everything. And then the system would go to court and they would deny return home. So she said, I'm going to do a family group conference for this family. And it was a Saturday, which, child welfare, sometimes we don't work on, some people do work on Saturdays, but it's oftentimes an 8 to 5 Monday through Friday kind of position, at least in ongoing casework. And she got 35 family members to come to this family group conference. And the purpose of the conference was to decide what to do with Frank Jr., right? And the family decided that with supports, Frank Jr. could go back and live with his mom and dad. And that happened in 2002. And so I meet Frank at this conference and he's going to present. And he has this manila envelope and I will remember it till the day I die. And he says, and it was 8 o'clock at night and we were walking through a conference lobby and I'm tired, right? We get up when we run these conferences and they're in person. You're usually down there at 6 and some meeting that, left us there until 8 p.m. And he said, do you have a minute? And I said, of course I do. And he said, I want to show you something. And I said, all right. And so he said, this is, and he had Frank Jr.'s report cards. He had his report cards and his behavior reports from when the kid was in, when his son was in foster care to now. Frank Jr. had been suspended. He was a very angry child. He was not performing well in school while he was in care. And he jumped around a bit, from foster home to foster home, which was oftentimes, he's not unusual. That happens for so many kids in care. And then he showed me, he goes, and now look at Frank Jr. And Frank Jr. was a straight A student. He was a quiet Taekwondo black belt. And he was the champion of the chess team. And I said, that's amazing. So why do you think that is? What happened? And he said, Frank Jr. came back to the place where he belonged. And I said, if I'm going to remain in child welfare, that's the kind of change I want to make. Yeah. It's for kids like Frank Jr. who they have the right to be part of their family system and at least have a chance of feeling like they belong. And so it's just something that sticks with me, that oftentimes we process people, we don't build relationships with the young people or the parents or their family systems, and we don't look to families as the solution. And ultimately, I believe in my heart that families, as imperfect as we are, right? And all of our families are messy. Every single one of our families is messy.
I've learned that, yes.
Right? And...
But it's our mess. It's our mess.
But it's our mess. It's our mess. And we have a vision. We have a vision for child welfare serving families, right? That we need to be in service to families.
Yes.
And that servant leadership, and that's kind of what we're hoping to inspire with all these professionals who have done an incredible amount of work in protecting children, because there are times where children absolutely do need to be protected, right? And we really want to get to the conversation of how do we support families differently.
I love that. And you said so many key pieces, and I've been there as well, being able to serve families. And, you know, think about, I've been complimented on, you know, a lot of families who, you know, have been sitting in the system for a minute, their kids, and I became their social worker. And I had a conversation, you know, one family, one mother, you know, she has some issues, but I listened to her and I didn't judge her. And, you know, when it was all said, she was able to get her kids back. And she said, you know what? She literally said, "You a dope social worker." And I was like, "What do you mean by that?"
And she That's quite a compliment.
Right. And she was like, "Cause you cool." And she was like, you see me, you see my kids, you know? And I appreciated that. And she would even email me to let me know how she was doing long after we got her case closed. And that was so rewarding for me, because it was like, hey, you might have issues, but your kids still should be with you. And we need to find ways to support you with that, right? Now, clearly we know there are cases where sometimes, you know, that might not be the route to get you back to your family. But, you know, I've had guests on the show and we've kind of talked about it and said, but I think we should still be looking and locating, like you said, other people in the family. You know, family isn't just consistent of, you know, mom and dad. Family stretches far beyond that. And, you know, I'd even beg to say, you know, someone who has lived, you know, in the system, and if I'm out, that family is who you make, you know, what you make it, right? So
absolutely,
who I consider to be, you know, people who are like sisters and, you know, close. They were mentors. You know, they were their mentors or their best friends. You know, my sisters are my best friends. You know, my mother figures are mentors. They didn't adopt me, but they adopted me. You see what I'm saying? We don't have court work,
right?
But
there wasn't a
legal process, but it was a belonging and acceptance, right? I see you and I want to be there for you. And I agree. I think we have a system that looks the other way to relationships. You know, one of the things that you were saying is like, you know, we need to have relationships. And I just want to emphasize that is to the listeners is like, really think and step back from the day to day and the mundane of doing the job. And I really want us to listen to what, you know, what you're saying, Lisa, and talking about seeing, you know, these families that we serve and that servant leadership and creating relationships. Because as a foster child, you know, we see it, but I can speak on it. You don't have time to build relationship because you're so busy jumping from one home to the next home. And all you know how to do is adapt. You know, you're in survival. You don't have time to cultivate a relationship. Matter of fact, you're probably scared of relationships after a while, you know, because you have no idea when you're going to lose that person, or you don't know how that person is going to treat you. So there's just so many different factors. But, you know, I thank you so much for sharing. And I want us to share this amazing conference. So share with us the details and how people can get registered. And I will also put those details in my episode notes.
That is awesome. Well, thank you again for this opportunity. I want to point your, when we're talking about the nuclear family, right, and how we, how every person kind of gets to define who's part of their family system. And it is blended with formal and informal kin. Those of us, those that we have a blood relationship to or blood ties to, and then so many other people in our family system who come from our community, our church, our schools, just people that have played a critical role in our life, our roommates, our friends, et cetera. And I just, before I tell you a little bit about the conference, I want to encourage your listeners. There's a really important essay that David Brooks wrote for The Atlantic. And I think it was in February of 2020. And it's called "The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake." And it's a long read, but it's a good read. And it's not necessarily totally connected to child welfare, but I think for those of us in this field, you'll find the connections. And what his basic premise is that when we started isolating into these nuclear families of mom, dad, and kind of became disconnected from our extended family systems, we lost a bit of a fabric of our society. So it's a great read. But our conference is coming up here in 2 weeks. It is live starting October 4th. And it runs from 6 in the morning Mountain Time to about 9:45 p.m. Mountain Time. So it's about 16 hours a day on October 4th. And we get up and we do it the same thing on the 5th, 6th, and 7th of October. What it allows people to do, we have 220 workshops. We have these things that we're calling international exchanges, where we're bringing thought leaders into the space on really challenging, interesting topics, everything from mandated reporting to radical solutions to state care. We're going to start talking about the disconnect oftentimes between social justice and child welfare. Think about, why do we in this country terminate parental rights? We've got people that are going to be talking about restorative approaches and ways to heal and how to create a sense of belonging. So there's a lot of, I would say, very optimistic and inspirational conversations. We have 8 keynotes. I've talked a little bit about our, you know, we have Dorothy Roberts. And I want to just also accentuate the one thing that we've tried hard to do, and I will admit we have not done it well enough, but we are committed to doing it better as we go, is we are inviting people with lived experience into the space, not just to participate, but to present. And with some support from the Annie E. Casey Foundation and Casey Family Programs, we actually have scholarships that will allow people with lived experience, so foster parents, adoptive parents, kin, and young people who have experienced care to come and teach us. Both as a, you know, and come into the space both as a learner as well as a teacher. And so a couple of our keynote panels are actually people with lived experience. Young people will start us off from around the globe, talking about their vision for kind of the next version or iteration of child welfare. And we end with kin and parents who have experienced the system, who have become advocates and have leveraged their expertise. So we're excited about that as well. We have intentionally priced this conference. Again, it's 16 hours a day, about 220 sessions. You can dip in and out as much as you like. And we've priced it so that to try to make it as affordable as possible. I mean, obviously it does take time and resources to put on an event like this, but we priced it at $100 per person. And we did that because we're really trying to create a playing field and possibilities for people, no matter where you sit in the system and how you serve children and families, to come into our space to become change agents with us. And so we're excited about that as well. And then the other piece about our conference that's kind of neat is, again, because we don't expect anybody to sit in the space for 16 hours a day. Although I will tell you, last year we had people who were from New York who were like, there at 1 in the morning because they're like, I had to go to this session. It was just so interesting. And we had people from Australia that were getting up at 3 in the morning who were like, this is so radical and interesting, right? And just
I
like
love it.
push. So we had people like getting up at all weird hours of the night who wanted to be a part of this community. And that's what we're hoping we get to this year again. But we also are recording the majority of the sessions. And so if you register for the conference, you will have access to about 160 recordings, I think, for up to a year. So we see this as a great training tool for systems, you know, a great opportunity for agencies that do lunch and learns to, you know, bring some of these recorded sessions into their space and talk about it further. So we don't see this as, you know, as a point in time. We see this as a journey.
Yeah.
We know system change takes a long time. And so we're in it for the long haul. And we're expecting, I think, over 2,000 people to come into the space this year. So we're, we're excited. We're excited. So go to KempConf. It's, you can register at kempconference.org, www.kemp, and it's K-E-M-P-E, conference.org. And, we welcome everybody into the space. Come curious, come ready to challenge and debate and discuss, learn, give of yourself, bring your openness and your ideas, and we can make a better tomorrow for children, families, and communities.
Absolutely. And that's what we're here for. And we're here to challenge the status quo. So listeners, please get registered. You do not want to miss this conference. I'm excited. I'll be there. So, you know, I'm highly recommending your presence at this wonderful conference. All right. So as we close out, I would love to just ask you, because I love to ask my guests about the keys to leading change for our listeners as they lead where they are in the field. So how can child welfare professionals lead the change and challenge the status quo in the field from your experience, Lisa?
I think we need to listen to people with lived experience. I think we need to become far more humble in thinking that we have the solutions for children and families, and instead think that they have the solutions for themselves, and they have the solutions for how these systems can be transformed. And if, you know, I'll stay in the transformation lane, how they can be transformed to really serve them. I think we need to start thinking of ourselves as servant leaders. And I think we need to start, and for me, as a white woman of privilege, right? And we need to become allies, and we need to understand the complexities of these structures of oppression that, quite frankly, history shows us and tells us that white women were critical in developing and perpetuating. And so I think humility is the most important trait I can bring into this work. My willingness to be a learner and to position others to lead us. And if I can do that with the remaining decade of my career, I will feel like perhaps I've made a small contribution.
I love that. And I love Lisa, and I appreciate you. I applaud you for also being very real and, you know, stating, you know, hey, you're a white woman of privilege. Because I think that a lot of people struggle with actually speaking out and acknowledging their privilege. So I just appreciate your level of awareness to that. And I think that makes us all better, because it's not a fight or a challenge against who has privilege or not. I think what is even more harmful is those that don't even admit the privilege that they have. They totally deny that there's any privilege difference, you know? So I appreciate that. And you use it well, and these keys are so important. It's something that we hear often, but I love how you presented that. So I appreciate that. You know, challenging status quo is what we're called to do as social workers. And I just want to thank you for being a leader in that, Lisa. I thank you for coming and sharing your knowledge and just being able to give us a resource as child welfare professionals that's really going to help us you know, take some action here, you know, and I pray that that's what we all, you know, get this experience and listen and what we've heard. I pray that's what we do after we also attend that conference. But thank you for this conversation, Lisha. I appreciate you so much.
Thank you, Cherish. I appreciate you as well.
All right. You too.
Bye-bye.
The book that I wrote is entitled How to Survive as a Child Welfare Social Worker. This book was written as a guide and knowledge to discuss the hidden work of child welfare and to have an actual hands-on approach from an experienced child welfare social worker who shares the pros and cons of the work and how to navigate the different stages of this rewarding career. If you have a passion for helping children, youth, and families to thrive in the community, being a child welfare social worker may be the ideal career choice for you.
Did you enjoy that conversation as much as I did? Well, if so, please take time to share this podcast with others. It's a free way to show your support. If you like what you hear on each episode, leave me a 5-star review on the platform you're tuning in on. Again, thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope to catch your ear for the next episode. Until then, challenge the status quo and lead change right where you are, because change starts with you.